L'une de mes toutes premières interviews, bien avant la création de Volant, date de 2011. J'étais à San Francisco et j'avais eu la chance de croiser la route d'un des fondateurs de Airbnb. Si vous cherchez sur un moteur de recherche, vous verrez que je n'étais pas très doué à l'époque d'ailleurs. Mais j'étais impressionné et ravi car j'ai toujours trouvé la capacité de Airbnb à créer une communauté de partage vraiment incroyable. Et donc depuis, l'appartement dont je suis propriétaire a toujours été sur Airbnb pour les moments où je suis en vacances ou simplement absent, car cela me permet d'arrondir les fins de mois. Avec ce supplément de revenus, je peux partir en voyage au Japon en 2016 par exemple, sans doute l'un de mes plus beaux voyages. Donc si vous avez une chambre de libre ou si vous partez en week-end, vous avez sans doute vous aussi un Airbnb. Pour découvrir combien pourrait vous rapporter votre logement, rendez-vous sur airbnb.fr/hôte. C'est airbnb.fr/hôte. H-O-T-E. Allez, place à l'épisode maintenant.
I don't do many episodes in English. Well, first because Vlan is a French podcast, but also because not everyone can understand English properly. But imagine the scene. You are in the French Alps with five people that you hardly know, to be honest, and one of them happens to be one of the top world photographers. I mean, this guy took the last photo of Steve Jobs for the cover of Time magazine. He took the photos of Barack Obama or Trump or any American president that can think about. He also took photos of any superstar in Hollywood that can think about. He worked with the National Geographic and with the United Nations. He actually won an Emmy Award for a series of photos he did for the Time magazine. He worked on movies like Homecoming or Marvel, like Black Panther, for example. And I guess, well, you want to share what that person has to say. I mean, at least I want to share what that person has to say, especially on a subject that is super important, which is the responsibility of holding a camera. Actually, when you put a picture out there, whether it's on your Instagram account or like him, like a photo that a lot of people will see, you have a responsibility. Maybe you don't think about it, but it's actually true. And Marco Grob, who is the person I'm interviewing, has many, many, many stories that you will love to hear about. I think you will love to understand his point of view regarding celebrities, regarding president, regarding portray, and also regarding social media. So I'll let you with the conversation. Allez, Vlan, c'est parti.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Marco. How are you doing?
I'm very good. How are you?
I'm pretty good, thanks. So you're a photographer, but you also have a lot of different things that you love. So I was wondering why in the first place you went into, why did you choose photography?
Well, actually, it came into my life like almost you fall in love with a woman you meet at the bar and you didn't expect anything to happen that night. In my life, I wanted to be a musician very bad. I was very ambitious. I rehearsed a lot, but ultimately I had an experience where I saw that I don't have that God-given talent, if you want, like you would need to pursue a career and have a good time and also leave something behind. And at the same time, at the almost same place, or actually at the same place, I had access to interesting things and stole my father's camera and started to do pictures. And then the world around me reacted with saying, oh, you do this very well. And that was the first time I heard that in my life. So I thought, okay, maybe that's worth pursuing. And in that process, I definitely fell in love with it. And I never fell out since. Which is a long, long, long time.
Long time ago. You do a different kind of photos and films also now. Mm-hmm. And to me, I feel like, but it's in my mind, that a photographer is always focused in one subject. And you do both Hollywood movies and documentaries in Africa or in other countries. Mm-hmm. How can this happen? How can you do like one day Black Panther and another day another thing?
Well, I think basically at one point in my life, when I went to New York, it was like that the boy, which was interested in history, and since I was very young, I was always very interested in history and politics in general and what's happening in the world, met the man who carried the camera.
Right.
And it was really a moment where I realized that destiny, I was lucky enough that I was put in a situation where I could start to to show a picture of the world I'm living in. I know of the limitations. It's only my view of the world. It's only Marco's world. But it's carried with subjects which matter to me. There's many different subjects which matter to me in social aspects, but also at the same time, I'm a movie buff. I grew up in Switzerland. Hollywood seemed so far away. Yeah. And all of a sudden, I find myself in the midst of that process. And I must say, I really thoroughly enjoy doing this kind of work. And then you mix it up with other subject matters, which are way deeper and I'm much more involve my personality much more deeper. And the other side more involves more, the photographer in me and the creative side.
Mm.
And I think this change is sometimes good and helpful. I have a lot of friends. They are photojournalists. I really admire them. Most of my photographer friends are actually photojournalists. And again, I admire them deeply. And I think they have a very important role in our daily lives, in politics, in showing what's happening in the world. But at the same time, I know also it can be very daunting for people to always be exposed to the worst of human condition over years and years and years and years. And so on my end, it's not that I didn't want to do that. I was never put in the situation. I was a portrait photographer by trade. And so I was never really a photojournalist. I mean, I was a journalist. I work journalistic. As soon as I work for a magazine, you become a journalist right away.
Yeah, right.
But it's not that I was a hardcore like photojournalist. But I know it can have very, it's daunting for a lot of people who do this kind of work.
Yeah, and in my case, I studied with marketing a few years back. And eventually, and this podcast was about marketing at the beginning, 4 years mm-hmm. ago. And then I gave myself freedom to go to the subject that I was very much more interested in, which was sociology, mm-hmm. Anthropology, geography, history, and all those subjects that I love. Was it the same for you? Like, did you felt that, or did you straight begin with both words, or you felt like you begin with trading, like somehow, and then give you the freedom to go somewhere else, or was it straight from the beginning you wanted to do both? Or, I mean, it's not only both, but
no, I think initially it was my interest in people in general. I think I'm interested in faces beyond the genetics. In every face, you see what life left behind. You see things like even social class. You see how they fed themselves, if they fed themselves, if they lived most of their lives in a happy or less condition. You see whether they smoke or not, and this all is all embedded in their faces, and it all tells a story. And in a weird way, as much as you want to, you can run, but you cannot hide. So your face, ultimately, if the other person is willing to look at it, will tell the story in its truth, and a lot of the truth. And if I met a lot of political leaders in my time, so I always question myself, how the hell could people vote for these people? Because it's all there. It's all almost on paper.
Oh, wow.
And very early in my life, I looked around in my universe, parents, their friends, tried to make sense of it. I tried to understand, is this all authentic? I didn't know the word yet as a kid, but that's probably what I was looking for. is this authentic? Are these people living an authentic life, and their body language, their demeanor, their what they said, the way they said it, and the tone they said it? So it kind of made me very early in my life a kind of an observer of humans, and without knowing it, it gave me that almost that understanding, which then later, when I started taking portraits, became very important to initially, the moment I see a person for the first time, have a very good sense of how to go through a sitting with them. And I don't know, it's a very interesting question. Why do I do both, and when did what come in my life? I think the movie thing came relatively late. I do this now for like 7, 8, maybe 9 years.
Right.
Nine years. I just did a film for Disney. I did the marketing posters and everything, and then from that moment on, it's like America, you know. It's not overnight. I wished it was, but it took a while. But then it started to become very, very frequent, and I always enjoyed working on that subject. At the same time, you always you, and you have to serve those things in within yourself, which is a deeper understanding of the world, and the people, and the politics made out of these people, and so I love to do both, and it's, I don't even question. I just go to work. For me, it's not like, oh, I do this now. It's just me reacting on a situation.
But what you were describing just earlier, to have this capacity of wondering, but also looking at things and looking at people and trying to understand what they went through their faces, it demands a lot of sensibility, don't you think? So you have a great sensibility as a human, you would say that?
I think, yeah, I think that's what I initially said. My circumstances in my earlier life forced me to probably, through the circumstance, that I wanted to make sense of the world around me, because I was not really impressed. I was not really impressed by the world around me. I thought something is off.
All right.
Something is not right. You know, but my parents were pretty happy. We had a pretty normal life. I grew up in the middle class, upper middle class in Switzerland. So what can you say? that's probably a very good starting point. And still, there was this coherent layer of something was off. And I always wanted to find out what the hell is going on here. And so it probably honed my sensibility to the point where I have to grab a situation very, very quickly when somebody walks in into the room where we photograph, mostly a room. I have to immediately make sense of, how do I do this? What's the strategy I do? Do I go close in the beginning, or do I go gently come in? It dictates actually really kind of the way I go through this shooting. And there's an example with Steve Jobs. the whole session lasted 3 hours and 20,
oh, wow,
48 seconds. And we did 2 covers and 3 inside pages for Time magazine there. Now, when he walked in, I remember my assistant told me, I turned around and gave her a look like, this has to go super fast. And I often show students pictures from that shoot. So the first shot, 42 seconds after he appeared in the door, is actually the cover.
Oh, wow.
The very first frame. And then his energy level really drops, one to another, one to another, one to another. Oh. So you have to feel... You have no second chances. I don't talk when people walk in. I kind of just observe. And even though he was very nice, and we had lunch after, he had time to do this, but he was extremely uncomfortable doing it. And there's even a video, you can find it online, the whole shoot,
okay,
with a timeline underneath for people who want to care about it. But it's really important for me to understand how my strategy of going through this situation. And with some people, you start further back and then move in to provoke a situation. Mm-hmm. And with him, I had to almost like in chess game, your opening strike is that to show, Steve, I'm in control, you're in good hands, and that's what we do. Now you're mine. And he reacted on that. But so it's a really interesting kind of a very exhausting actually game. I think it's super exhausting.
After
like 3 minutes, 5 minutes, I'm trained. It's really all your senses are with this person, and you see sometimes their hand clench like they would be on a dentist chair.
Do they?
Yeah, sometimes they do. It's all their demeanor else, they train themselves to look relaxed, you know?
Yeah,
they
sure.
give you a smile. And smile is our first way of deception. That's the human deception, the first row of deception. And people, that's why politicians smile. If somebody smiles, you lose a lot of the information which is actually embedded in the face.
Oh.
And it almost puffs away. That all this information is almost gone. That's why these guys always smile. And I often, like, for example, when I shot Donald Trump, he would say, can I smile? I said, well, you can, but we won't print it.
Oh, wow. I never thought about a smile like that. Actually, I'm a very smiley person.
Yeah, so. You're a smiley person, but that is your nature.
Yeah.
And you can see when you can read your face, that's your modus operandi. You know, it's like, it's really there and it's not fake. That's who you are.
Yeah.
With certain people,
Donald Trump for sure.
you see immediately, this is his way of deception, and you have to not allow him this deception, no matter what. And my game is not to make friends with these people. I don't want to be friends with these people.
No.
My game is to get out of this. Yeah, maybe my view of this person. I admit it's always the photographer I don't say per se all of the work you do has to have a complete show, a complete picture. I don't think you can. I don't think everything in one shot. To be honest, I learned then later doing documentaries, there's much more layers to things normally. I exclude Trump of this. But else than that, it's an interesting dynamic, which I enjoy thoroughly. And it's, you have to stay on the story as a journalist, you know. For me, it's the same thing. I have to stay on the story and I have to kind of illustrate the story, which then is written in the magazine with my work to the best extent I can.
So the discussion we had earlier was about the responsibility of holding a camera. Mm-hmm. And does, I guess, I don't know if it's the same actually when you do a documentary in some, countries, wherever, like, or tribes, let's say, and when you do a photography of someone who is powerful, because we tend to give power to people in politics or fame, let's say. To you, is it the same responsibility, what you're going to show to the world when you do the cover of the Time, or when you tell a story through a documentary?
Well, you know, I'm full aware that I have very limited possibilities in a way, you know. But, you know, I often say, you know, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a... I have no cure for cancer, nor for HIV, nor for any of other diseases, certainly not corona, I wish that it. But the one thing I can do and want to do is to put my power into where I see issues and document that for the world to see, either to react on it, or even as a document that this exists, as a really documentarian. I think everyone, and this is a call for everyone, imagine those, we all know these pictures of the policeman shooting someone in the back in the US several times actually, or the person, poor man's being struggled and strangled to death. Mm-hmm. all of these would not have been even put to court if not some brave soul would have pointed his camera to it or her camera to it. So it's the responsibility when you carry camera, and that we all do with a cell phone, is to take, actually to think about that this is always a document as well, which can result in change. Because if people don't know what's happening, they will not react on to make it happen. And so it's a really really more call for everyone to think about it, that we all have the power to point our cameras in a direction where things happened which are not right. And it's a part of our almost collective memory, if you want. Mm-hmm. Sometimes our powers are very limited. You know, my power, I work for some of the biggest news agencies in the world, and I'm very well aware that my power is completely limited. But when I, for example, I did a documentary with, and part of it was George W. Bush.
Right.
And so in that documentary, he says that throwing the first ball after 9/11 to opening the baseball season, and he said it three times into the camera, was the most nervous he has been in his entire presidency. And I recall a man who started two wars says that. So to be the man there to record that and to show this to the world gives my life a purpose.
Totally.
Because, you know, imagine that's who we give power to people who really then after starting two wars was still last, which destabilized the whole region in the world. In all honesty, their biggest problem was to throw a freaking ball. And I remember the moment he said that, we were looking at each other. I looked at the recording device. I saw the levels going right, you know. I looked left we looked at each other and said, like, he didn't say that. And then he said it again. And he said it a third time. And so, you know, it's not always as powerful as this, because the world then after showing this reacted highly, and Bush got he got pretty hammered. So that made me feel pretty good. Because in the end, at least I ask for reflection. At least I ask these people for some form of reflection. Because all the leaders of states, the state leaders I met, I have always... You get always like this offerings of friendship, because Hitler would be nice to me.
I guess so.
You know, he would say, "Mr. Krupp, welcome to the Reich Chancellery. How is the Hotel Adelon? Everything all right?" You know, they give you the schmooze. You know, I don't take these offers, because for me, all of them are men or women who get up in the morning, look in the mirror, and say, "I have what it takes to lead a nation with 380 million people to the next 4 years and the biggest a military arsenal in history." I don't know. When I looked in the mirror, I don't see a man like that.
No.
I know I can't. So what make them believe they can? Everyone should always, if they look at leaders, always ask themselves the question, how the hell does he come to the conclusion that he can do that or she can do that? For me, it's a miracle. And I want to just show that person and ask, no, I don't have answers, but I can ask the question, why did you elect this man?
And you were talking about the responsibility of holding the camera, but when you look at social media and what people are showing on social media, it also has or advertising actually, it has an impact on how we define happiness, success, and what we see on social media still is this accumulation sensation, accumulation of power, things, you know, traveling. We are on vacation right now. So, you know, going far away or going to Greece or wherever where it's burning. And do you think like people also have a responsibility in showing that or?
People normally, as I understand, and I mean, in a certain way, I'm the same way too. We want to live a life in peace and in somewhat prosperity. We want to be safe and as safe as we can in this multiverse of ours. And then at the same time, we we want to do, a lot of us, I think we want to do the right thing. There's a growing conscience towards the environment and towards social injustices, and we want to do the right thing. But I cannot expect people to do that. I cannot call out and ask to do that. For me, that I have to do it as a journalist is almost a given. You know, I have to. It's a part of my profession.
Right.
Nevertheless, I just in this I want to say for people to think about their power and the perceptions they make out in the world with pictures. I don't post on Instagram. I mean, I have an Instagram, but I only post like every 2 years to the disgust of many of my colleagues. They say you're crazy because I have a pretty interesting life, but this is mine. I don't need to post that. It's private. I'm very blessed to see, you know, some really incredible stuff, but I don't need to post that all the time. You know, it seems unhumble, you know, almost to show the whole world, look how well I am, and the perception, because I'm not always well, even if, no. if it might look, of course not. I wished I am, but I'm not. But that upkeeping of a perception you're not is for me very foreign. It's not something I really like. And for me, honestly, selfies, for example, when I was a kid, to make a picture of yourself was considered kind of vain and kind of stupid.
Yeah.
And we live in a world where really people, and I watched scenes, we all did, like, you know, first of all, the positioning, and then we check it out on the phone, and then the leg comes up, the selfie, I call this the selfie leg. And to do this in public, for me, it's just weird and foreign, honestly. Maybe I'm an old man, but I don't understand that. Because in my world, honestly, those people who have really the attention, like all these, a lot of these famous people, they hate to be photographed. They hate to be photographed. It's almost like, and honestly, as a photographer, I say, when you like to be photographed, you should probably see a shrink.
Well, yeah. I believe that you should always see a shrink if you can. If you can afford it.
I agree. I totally agree with that. But,
I understand the point.
Obviously, totally when you really kind of overly like yourself on pictures, that's probably a sign that
there's something wrong.
Don't get me wrong. I'm happy for everyone who feels good in his own, in her or his good own skin. Absolutely. But this is such a nice, beautiful thing, and it's to be carried inside. To carry that so much in the outside and project something with it, for me, has something extremely vulgar. As a photographer, I say it's had something extremely vulgar.
But then I'm wondering because, I mean, somehow for business purpose, Instagram is part of the game. So I see a lot of photographs who actually post on Instagram because, and they're active on Instagram because, well, it's also part of the game, kind of. Don't you think, don't you, I mean, because when I'm thinking about the way I use Instagram myself, I guess, I, or maybe I'm justifying myself, that's also totally possible, that it, this is part of the game because this is business somehow.
Yeah, on a business standpoint, I agree. I should do way more. I have ridiculously much followers for not actually posting.
Yeah,
I should probably do more. I could do more. Maybe it comes to my lack of, maybe it's not good for me at one point. But I just frankly, I'm bored of Instagram. You see, I often like students, for example, students, I ask them, so before they go to work in the morning, do you guys go on Instagram? And all of them are.
Yeah.
And I say, imagine the Beatles would have looked at or heard 10 albums before they went to Abbey Road studios to record theirs. We wouldn't have those albums we know now. it's always an overlayering thing, especially now talking to photographers. It's an overlayering thing in your brain, actually limiting your own creativity. If you look at other people's work, look at paintings, look at listen to music, look at beautiful food, look at landscapes, look at whatever you want, whatever makes you happy. But maybe before you go to work, don't look at photographs, because you will take this as a layer in your brain to work. And I think it's a very stupid idea.
But it's super profound. I think for a lot of people, they don't even think about that, I guess. It's just like a, well,
a habit.
A habit. Yeah, yeah. Totally. It's, mm-hmm. it's totally a habit. And it's also a social integration thing. Like you are on Instagram because a lot of things are happening there and you're like, it would be weird not to be there, or it could be, you know, like a social standpoint not to be there. You know, I know a lot of people like, yeah, no, I don't post on Instagram. Mm-hmm. I'm not even on social media. Mm-hmm. But it's more like a position that they have to the world. Like they want to position themselves against social media. But mm-hmm. The way you reflect on things is, to me, super interesting.
Well, the thing is in general. For me, social media is a mass produced, even through individuals, a mass produced content spitting machine. Okay,
totally.
And I'm not interested in mass. I don't need to eat a lot of food. I'd much rather have good food and healthy food, or at least food I like. I drink wine, for example, when it's really good wine, and otherwise I leave it alone. If I would not have the money for it, I would drink wine once a month or every 3 months, but that's how I am.
I would not
want to see 150 average pictures or boring pictures over breakfast on Instagram. Why should I do this? Would you read a book which is completely like average and then take another book which you know is average? And for me, that doesn't make any sense.
No.
Even the entertainment level of on it is actually, I think, so low. You do it because it's a habit. I watch people do it because it's a habit. But if they really think at the end of the week, how much did I take out of this? How much did I learn? How much did it inspire me? Or how much did it touch me? It's super minimal. You could have that much of getting stimulated by any sense. You could get in pretty much anything of other outlets. It doesn't need social media for that.
Totally.
And obviously it's clear I'm not a big fan, especially of Facebook and stuff like that. I think they are outright dangerous for our democracies. I don't understand how people who made that much money don't come to the conclusion it's maybe time to stop. Mm-hmm. They have kids. They raised kids. I don't know what kind of world they want to live it, have it live in. For me, it's a miracle.
Yeah, I don't understand it either. Going back to National Geographic, I'm changing subject completely, mm-hmm. but I'm super interested in understanding, because when we talk about the responsibility of holding a camera, then when you go to people that you want to explain life or explain experiences to people that obviously don't know them that well, in which mindset are you in to do that? And how do you do it? How do you make sure that this is the story you want to tell?
I mean, the one thing I worked most of it, like over the last 10 years, was my involvement with the United Nations Mine Action Service. It was actually, I was always following over years and years. I was always kind of interested, like what's happening when a conflict ends. Okay. So the conflict itself is the conflict, but then there's the time after.
Totally.
That means, most countries are heavily mined. There's a lot of remnants of war in terms of ammunition and stuff of war. And then we had a discussion over dinner with friends, and I got really passionate about it. And the next day, a guy calls me from en masse from United Nations Mine Action Service and said, hey, my friend told me you're really passionate about like this subject matter. Would you like to go on a mission for us? And I said, oh, absolutely. And he said, Afghanistan? And was still in the war. And I said, yeah, sure. And he said, oh, no, you can think about it. And I said, I just did. And so we went there. And quite frankly, after seeing the gravity of the problem in first place, and even those trips sometimes were quite challenging in terms of, you know, how you personally deal with what you see. You cannot walk away from the responsibility anymore because you get really passionate about, say, this has to stop. And my work then was to actually inform the public or help, more or less, help the en masse to inform the public that there's still about 300 million mines out there. There's still piles of unexploded munitions and people who suffer the consequences. And so it felt, you know, it felt right to do that. And in weirdly enough, it turned out to be one of the most, if not the most gratifying experience of my professional life. Because as a human, I learned definitely the most in this and not in a movie studio in Hollywood, you know.
For sure.
So I think it's a privilege of my life that for my life that I was asked to do this work, and I hope we can proceed doing this as soon as Corona was kind of making it harder, but I hope we can get on with this because the problem is not going away just because of Corona.
Yeah, totally. And you showed me that picture, talking about mines, you showed me that picture in Mali with all these ammunitions that were still armed, mm-hmm. and kids playing with it. Well, the playing with it was in Afghanistan, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, especially young boys, especially in Cambodia, during what we call the Vietnam War, but in Cambodia and Vietnam, they call it the American War.
Interesting.
So the Americans dropped like over 300 million cluster ammunition containers, of which most of them, a lot of them, didn't explode. And it saturates actually Cambodia with unexploded airdropped ammunitions. And especially little boys, they have about the size of a tennis ball. And especially little boys are extremely in danger because they use it as toys. And in Afghanistan, the Russians dropped stuff which looks like toys too. And so there's a lot of kids exposed, but the problem is way bigger than this. It's imagine your city. Imagine you live in Lisbon. And imagine there's one landmine in Lisbon. Nobody would move out of their house until you have found it.
True.
And in Afghanistan, there are still 20 million landmines out there. Only in Afghanistan. So, and a lot of people are scared of mines and maybe they are not even there. But how could they know? You know, what you have to have the people going there and trying to find them and declare landscape for free and safe before. And they do it. They told me they do it as they would let their kids play football on it.
Right.
That's how accurate they work. And unless this is declared safe, people wouldn't be able to, you know, do agriculture in certain areas and so forth. So the problem is tremendous and it didn't go away. There's a lot of problems we have in this world. And for people, this is not the most urgent one. But my job is also to convince the people who fund these institutions to keep up their work and keep on funding it. It's less on a public sometimes spread. It's more on a political spread that you know that people get the money, that the en masse and the other institutions in demining get the money to do their work, because to put in a landmine costs $2 and to take one out is $2,000.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, whatever helps. And that is a part of a part. I play a little part in their endeavor to do so.
And you told about you told us about stories around Bush and Trump, but you also have a lot of personal stories with people that are completely unknown, obviously. Mm-hmm. People that you've seen, whether in Asia or in Africa or in wherever region. I'm sure you have, and I remember this photo of this woman carrying a huge gun, telling stories about those people also, because I think those photos are super powerful, but also when I look at that photo, I can imagine a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And is it what you are looking for, or is it you're trying to tell a story? Or do you believe that a photo can come without a text explaining it?
Well, before I started filming, I thought maybe there is a chance to show more in a picture. And then you start filming and you do interviews to the photos. And then you watch the interviews and say, shit, my photography actually sucks. It's not good enough. So the next time you do it, you have this in mind and you work extra hard on the pictures, because in any film content, you have the spoken word, which is extremely powerful. You have music, you have pictures, you have the whole nine yards. It's a whole broadside on your senses, while the photo is very quiet. In the photo, I try the opposite thing. I rarely give directions. I kind of generate a vacuum. And when you generate a vacuum, for example, you sit with someone across someone and you don't talk, I promise you, you make the other one talk. So in a way, you force the other one to fill that vacuum with whoever she or he is.
Right.
And it's never a part of the full story. I've given up on that hope. But it's that moment in time in her life or his life. And that's all I can do. And you see a lot of the things happening within this case of this woman herself, the natural way she holds this AK-47 is completely natural to her. You know, it's she even has the finger on the trigger, and it tells the story.
Totally.
It's only a part of the story, but it's what I think photography, or that the one photography I can do, does. And then there's other ways of documenting things, and they tell other stories.
Mm-mm.
And probably in the end, you have a part of the story with 10 photographers and movie teams, and you're still probably only scratching the surface.
One thing that I would like to scratch also, I'm thinking about Netflix and documentaries, because the way the Netflix documentaries are made, usually, I mean, this is my point of view, they are super subjective. Like, they want to make a point, and so they go directly there. And so they miss somehow the complexity while doing that. I'm wondering, what would you say to people when they are watching documentary to take care of? Do you understand what I mean? Like,
yes,
how do you watch a documentary, basically? Or how do you watch photos?
Well, I sometimes, when I watch documentary, of which these days a lot seem extremely formulated, it's almost following a formula. And I prefer long-form documentary, because you have much more time to establish news, to bring in other sources on and have a complete different opinion, which is important. I just, you know, I agree with you. Some stuff goes right to the target and leaves out a lot of the gray tones and tends to be more black and white. As a viewer of a documentary, I would always want to have included as many gray tones as possible to not give me answers, but almost ask me to ask questions. What's going on here, and why is this way longer than you actually watch the documentary itself? A good documentary for me actually starts working when you've finished watching. That it comes with you, and it keeps asking you questions, and I think that's a very well done documentary. And of those, there are many, and there's a great many fantastic documentary filmer on this globe doing. Imagine when I was a kid, the only people telling us how the ocean looks was Jean Cousteau,
yeah,
a great idol of mine. Jean Cousteau in the Calypso, you know, at their ship. I mean, I was like obsessed. And they were the first people, and then Ernst Haas, who were able to show us how it is under the surface of the ocean.
Totally.
There's people out there, we would not know certain species. Some people, like our friends like Paul Nicklin, he's mostly in the polar region. He's an expert in the polar region. He and I really encourage everyone to look at his Instagram, Paul Nicklin. He shows actually the situation of the polar region like nobody else I do. How else would we know about those subject matters if not people would freeze their ass off for us?
Yeah, totally.
You know, and there's so many people who kind of do this kind of work, and I really admire all of them. Without them, I would not know even on what planet I live, to be honest, because I've traveled a lot, but I haven't seen by far all these places. We wouldn't know what the beauty of this planet entails without these very people, either film, documentary, or photos, or writers. But I respect that extremely much, and I think it's in a very important part of our, you know, being a human in 2021 is to understand what planet are we living on.
Talking about that, you told me that story about astronauts and what their experience was when they weren't out there. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about it?
Well, I did a weirdly enough, my first recallable memory in my life is the moon landing, the first moon landing, where my dad put me in front of the TV. So I always tell students, you have to cover the stories you're personally interested in. And weirdly enough, I end up doing a story of an astronaut. That's, you know, it's going full circle. It's almost your radio controlled, and you do follow that inner voice. So I did a story with, actually quite many stories, but one in particular with Scott Kelly, the first American in space, for a year. He was in space for a year. So in that whole wake of working space-related, I met many people who were in space, and all of them shared one thing. It takes 2.5 minutes until you are in orbit. Only 2.5 minutes after takeoff. And when you look out of the window, it almost makes you take your breath away when you look at this very thin blue line. We never see it because we only see it on TV or so. But when you see it, apparently I've never seen it, unfortunately. But this is a very thin light blue line, and it looks like a piece of paper laying on a table. And all of what keeps us alive is that sheet of paper, thin compared to the world. And when they come back from space, they have a very different point of view about pollution than they had before. Even when they were concerned before, they come back and are super concerned before, because that thin thing is the wall to our spaceship, and we all drill holes in it.
Living
on a daily basis. I do, you do, we all do. Mm-mm. It's kind of crazy, isn't it?
It is totally crazy.
It's crazy. And so it's very interesting to share, to hear from people who have complete different experiences than I have or ever could have probably. And it's very profound, and it's actually profound not for them. It's quite profound for all of us.
Yeah. And also you told me that story of this photo from this, it was 3 years ago, right? When they sent a machine out of the solar system, and there was a photo taken.
Yes. Well, it was like being at NASA at one point, a team showed me that photo. So when Voyager left in 72, they shot out a Voyager 1 and 2 into actually kind of towards the edge of our universe, or not, but our solar system, pardon me. And it took off in 72, and it left our solar system, I believe it was 2-3 years ago. And on the way out, the scientists had actually a very great idea to turn the camera around and say, okay, where did we come from? Let's shoot the picture just out of the back mirror. And the data came in and they looked at the picture and you saw obviously very prominent the outer ring. In the outer ring, you saw Jupiter in its might. And then one guy said, holy shit, where are we? So the whole team was looking on this picture. And after a while, they saw one blue pixel. And they said, shit, this is us, that blue pixel in this infinite black. In a solar system, which is part of a universe where all the scientists I've ever met say is a part of a multiverse. When that doesn't make you humble, I don't know what would.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And understanding that we are just little things. We all live in the same boat. That's also something that when I see all those walls for whatever power, I'm like, don't they understand, like, How is that even possible?
Well, that's another experience you hear a lot of time. We have to understand most astronauts, especially up to the 90s, were cold warriors. Either they were Russian fighter pilots by trade or American fighter pilots by trade. They were trained to actually they were pretty straight line cold warriors. All of them looking out of the window said, what the hell are we doing?
Yeah.
This is so stupid. Like, I don't see borders. I don't even see that. I mean, I know where the Soviet Union is, but I don't see it. I don't see any threat. I just see this underneath here, 400 kilometers away. It's the only place we can exist. And I think it's pretty crazy to hear that from, they were not like, you know, they were not hippies. You know, they were really kind of trained. They invested a lifetime to actually train themselves to kind of shoot down the other side. And to hear that is, for me, actually quite meaningful, because it also shows that experiences can change your perceptions, and that's what we all should do. We kind of challenge ourselves to sometimes our experiences, which shape some things stuck in our head, can definitely change with a different viewpoint. And I think having so many different cultures on the world, having so many different lifestyles is, for me, I see this as the greatest blessing, because it also includes a different viewpoint, and that's what I, in the end, can only profit from. I wouldn't want to have the whole world Swiss.
Yeah.
That's, for me, an apocalyptical nightmare, to be honest. I'm Swiss, I'm white, I'm like a white Swiss man. Yeah. The idea of having Switzerland larger than it is, for me, is not a good one, I tell you honestly. No. I want different shapes and tones and colors and feels and foods and all of this beauty of what humans being can do. They do also a lot of crap. Mm. But all those beautiful things they can do, I want to have as a part of my everyday life. And I'm not willing to not eat the beauty of other foods I know I was not raised on. And I think that's a very very important part of actually traveling and experiencing the world. And the older I get, the more I know that I don't know anything at all. So it makes you even more curious. So
I have two questions. One is a question that you probably are asked a lot, which is, who did you meet that, like, struggled you the most or shocked you the most? And the other one I'll ask you later.
I don't know. I think, you know, a lot of people ask me, well, you meet a lot of famous people, you know. But actually, to be honest, fame fell off.
Totally.
And that's very important for a portrait photographer. My assistants often laugh, because when you're somewhere in like, you know, wherever and let's say you're with a tribe in Mali or in Sudan or in some place like that, they said you get so much more excited than I ever saw you before. You know, you're all awake. You're all, for me, I don't treat people differently, and I met kings and queens and presidents. And for me, I really honestly say that it's, I think honestly, those people, like the famous people, like that I treat, they feel that I have a sense for democracy in that sense, and treat them the same like I would treat anyone else. And I think I hate when I with someone and have dinner and somebody doesn't treat the waiter right.
Yeah,
I hate that's that for too. Me a complete cutoff.
Okay? To me too.
You know,
it's really when dating, it's horrible.
Oh yeah, no. Okay. And that's it. Goodbye. Sayonara. It's not happening. So for me, this is really kind of respect towards everyone. And yeah, you sometimes meet, of course, you meet someone who did, like a musician who did the soundtrack to your life. And then it turns out to be a very nice guy. And of course, that's exciting in that sense. And it's also weird at times, I'm still in my head like this kid from small town who asks himself, actually, I'm not even supposed to be here. Why am I in this room with this person? You know, it's almost this out of body experience in a way. But so it is for me to be on a square in a camp with a tribe or with, you know, with people who got harmed by landmines. They need my respect as much.
Oh, totally.
As a famous person does, for sure.
Actually, when I asked the question, I was expecting you to tell me a story of someone completely unknown, because to me, those are, I mean, not more interesting. It doesn't, I'm not like, I don't know, like Biden or whoever is less interesting than whoever in Sudan, but I was actually expecting that you would tell me that.
No, there's one particular man. I had the privilege to meet a lot of people. A lot of them were not famous. Some were. Judge really about that. Some of them might be, some of them might not. But particularly one man, he's not super famous, but his name is Daniel Kish. He turned blind because of, I think, retina cancer when he was like, I think, 4 years old.
Wow.
And when I met him, the first time initially in his house, he had four glass eyes in his hand, two of them brown and two of them blue. And he said, which one do you want? You can also mix. Of course, great sense of humor. But then I met this man and I went on a hike with him. And they know him as the Batman. He makes noise, and the reflection of the noise, almost like a sonar, gives him an idea of the room.
Oh, wow.
And the place and the distance and the size of the room. Is there a window? Is there a door? And you walk with this man, and after 2 hours walking through the forest, there was a sign in the forest, and he walked to that sign like this. Like, I mean, I would have almost checked, is this guy really blind or is he faking me? Because we were crossing rivers, and then he held his hand on that sign and said, here's the sign, we have to go right, and then it's only 20 minutes to my cabin. So you have a man who overcame everything life threw at him. And he did it with such a grace and with such a power that it would take my breath away. On top of it, he's extremely articulate. And he now teaches other blind people to get the same technique, which can make a huge difference in their lives.
Wow.
And you walk away from situations like that where you go like, wow, what did I do? I make pictures. How ridiculous. Other people is, for example, you know, there are people in, like, let's say in the civil rights movement, I had the honor to meet, and you have conversation with him and it reflects more on you. Like, John Lewis, for example, he was incarcerated 23 times by the time he was, or 40 times by the time he was 23. he had always a toothbrush with him because he said, like, when you get to jail, you need a toothbrush. And he had a one with himself always.
Wow.
And he told me the story that it was in the office with JFK, with President Kennedy, his brother Bobby Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. And they informed them that they will do a march to Washington. And apparently JFK got up and said, you shouldn't do that. The FBI will tack something on you. They will make riots and then blame you for riots and stuff. And in 1961, John Lewis, in the Oval Office, towards the President of the United States, 23 years old, says, we're not here to ask you for your permission, sir. We're just here to inform you that we will make a march to Washington.
Wow.
And for me, it's like, in a time when people went to jail for activism, when people kind of think that's what, it's enough to be on Facebook and post a black sign and do all of these things. Those are only optics. And then you meet a man who dared to go on the street to fight for what he thought was right. And we know, for me, deeply believe it is right. With no scare for his own life, with no scare for his own personality, being imprisoned countless times. It was really kind of, it's for me as a person really important to meet people like that, because you have to ask yourself, and every of your listeners have to ask himself, am I one of these keyboard activists who go on their dating profiles and say, I'm an activist? No, you're not.
No,
change happened on the street.
Yeah.
And it happens with people like John Lewis or other people, and there's many people in this world, and some of them have not even a name.
Mm-hmm.
But these are the people which you walk away from and you go like, oh man, and you're shaken with respect. And I still am. I mean, I watched a documentary about John Lewis, who passed away not long ago. And I had teary eyes because I had quite a time with him and quite a lot of time with him. And it's just amazing to meet people like that who made change. That's for me almost the biggest. Mandela or John Lewis or people like that who kind of really invested their life in making a positive note for hundreds and thousands of millions of people. That's for me, the people really, and Daniel Kish, people like that, of course.
Yeah, amazing. And I told you I had two questions. So that was the first one. The second one, probably more complicated, but what is the question you are never asked and you think that would be super important to be asked as a photographer?
That's a good one, and I'm taken by surprise. I have to think. I mean, I have to think about that.
Go.
I mean, in one way, after all these years, and I really love photography, nobody ever asked me whether I love to do a session, because I'm somehow not. You're sweating. It's kind of almost a panic situation, because you always try to do your best, and sometimes your best is not good enough, and you know that, and you know your limitations. So actually, I don't really enjoy the act of doing a portrait that much.
Oh.
I like everything before, and I like everything after, and I love that I can do that so much, and I love photography, and I love a different photography to the core of my heart. But man, I don't know. I mean, the session itself is actually, it's actually pretty brutal.
I believe
I must
you.
Say, it's really yeah. brutal. And that's maybe why I sometimes really enjoy directing films, because it's kind of, you sit on your chair with a coffee and everyone does something and it's much more relaxed on a physical side. But that nobody ever asked me, are you really enjoying this? Because they always think, oh, this is so fun. You meet all these famous people, blah, blah, blah. But never ask me someone, yeah, how does it feel to meet? You have to always like juggle egos. And I don't only mean famous people. I was with tribes in Africa, for example, in Ethiopia. And you juggle the egos of people there too, just
totally.
To be clear.
Yeah.
Very clear. This is... Well, this is the same. We're human, and people want to show them in their best light, and that's exactly the same like you would work with George Clooney, you know.
Interesting. This podcast called Vlan, so it's another petit pair for slamming the door. Mm-hmm. So I would like to know, what would you open the door to, or what would you slam the door to? Whether you can do one or two or both or whatever.
I mean, I open the door always to, it's almost a paradox. I open the door always to gray tones, to complexity, to the miracle of life itself, and to understand our place in history and time, and also in the world, and then in the biggest sense of the multiverse we live in. Respect, all of that is included in this law of respect, to find the beauty in the other, not the threat. I slammed the door at the same time when I asked for tolerance and everything in this door. I slammed the door on racism completely. It's one of the, and probably stays like a stain on our existence until we eradicate ourselves because of it in one end or another. I think it's shameful. We all have things in us, but for whatever reasons. But I just ask everyone to, when you find it, to ask yourself, okay, why do I have it, and how can I fight it? Because it's wrong. Mm. It's wrong. It's just not an option.
Totally wrong.
It's not my option. Never.
Cool. Thank you very much, Marco.
You're very welcome.
Merci d'avoir écouté Vlan. Si vous avez aimé l'émission, n'hésitez pas à mettre des étoiles sur vos plateformes de podcast préférées. Vous pouvez aussi partager l'épisode sur vos réseaux sociaux, Instagram Stories, Facebook, LinkedIn, où vous voulez. Je suis Grégory Pouy. Vous pouvez me retrouver sur l'intégralité des plateformes sous le nom Greg from Paris. Si vous avez des idées pour des invités, si vous avez des commentaires, n'hésitez surtout pas à m'envoyer un message. Allez, merci et à bientôt.